This is Audible.
Without Remorse by Tom Clancy. This book is read by Michael Pritchard. Arma virumque cano, Publius Virgilius Maro. Beware the fury of a patient man. John Dryden. Prologue. Meeting places. November. Camille had either been the world's most powerful hurricane or the largest tornado in history. Certainly it had done the job to this oil rig, Kelly thought, donning his tanks for his last dive into the Gulf. The superstructure was wrecked, and all four of the massive legs weakened, twisted like the ruined toy of a gigantic child. Everything that could safely be removed had already been torched off and lowered by crane onto the barge they were using as their dive base. What remained was a skeletal platform which would soon make a fine home for local game fish, he thought, entering the launch that would take him alongside. Two other divers would be working with him, but Kelly was in charge. They went over procedures on the way over, while a safety boat circled nervously to keep the local fishermen away. It was foolish of them to be here. The fishing wouldn't be very good for the next few hours, but events like this attracted the curious. And it would be quite a show, Kelly thought, with a grin, as he rolled backwards off the dive boat. It was eerie underneath. It always was, but comfortable, too. The sunlight wavered under the rippled surface, making variable curtains of light that trained across the legs of the platform. It also made for good visibility. The C-4 charges were already in place, each one a block about 6 inches square and 3 inches deep, wired tight against the steel and fused to blow inward. Kelly took his time, checking each one, starting with the first rank 10 feet above the bottom. He did it quickly because he didn't want to be down here that long, and neither did the others. The men behind him ran the primacord, wrapping it tight around the blocks. Both were local, experienced UDT men, trained almost as well as Kelly. He checked their work, and they checked his, for caution and thoroughness was the mark of such men. They finished the lower level in 20 minutes, and came up slowly to the upper rank, just 10 feet below the surface, where the process was repeated, slowly and carefully. When you dealt with explosives, you didn't rush, and you didn't take chances. Colonel Robin Zacharias concentrated on the task at hand. There was an SA-2 site just over the next ridge. Already it had volleyed off 3 missiles, searching for the fighter bombers he was here to protect. In the back seat of his F-105G Thunder Chief was Jack Tate, his bear, a lieutenant colonel and an expert in the field of defense suppression. The two men had helped invent the doctrine which they were now implementing. He drove the Wild Weasel fighter, showing himself, trying to draw a shot, then ducking under it, closing in on the rocket site. It was a deadly, vicious game, not of hunter and prey, but of hunter and hunter, one small, swift and delicate, and the other massive, fixed and fortified. This site had given fits to the men of his wing. The commander was just too good with his radar, knowing when to switch it on and when to switch it off. Whoever the little bastard was, he'd killed 2 weasels under Robin's command in the previous week. And so the colonel had drawn the mission for himself as soon as the frag order had gone up to hit this area again. It was his specialty, diagnosing, penetrating, and destroying air defenses. A vast, rapid, 3-dimensional game in which the prize of winning was survival. He was roaring low, never higher than 500 feet, his fingers controlling the stick semi-automatically, while Zacharias's eyes watched the karst hilltops, and his ears listened to the talk from the back seat. "He's at our 9, Robin," Jack told him. "Still sweeping, but he doesn't have us. Spiraling in nicely." "We're not going to give him a shrike," Zacharias thought. They tried that the last time, and he spoofed it somehow. That error had cost him a major, a captain, and an aircraft. A fellow native of Salt Lake City, Al Wallace. Friends for years. Damn it, he shook the thought off, not even reproving himself for the lowercase profanity. Giving him another taste, Zacharias said, pulling back on the stick. The thud leapt upwards into the radar coverage of the site, hovering there, waiting. This site commander was probably Russian-trained. They weren't sure how many aircraft the man had killed, only that it had been more than enough. But he had to be a proud one because of it, and pride was deadly in this business. Launch, two. Two valid launches, Robin, Tate warned from the back. Only two, the pilot asked. Maybe he has to pay for them, Tate suggested coolly. I have them at 9. Time to do some pilot magic, Rob. Like this? Zacharias rolled left to keep them in view, pulling into them, and split-essing back down. He'd planned it well, ducking behind a ridge. He pulled out at a dangerous low altitude, but the SA-2 guideline missiles went wild and dumb 4,000 feet over his head. I think it's time, Tate said. I think you're right. Zacharias turned hard left, arming his cluster munitions. The F-105 skimmed over the ridge, dropping back down again while his eyes checked the next ridge, 6 miles and 50 seconds away. His radar is still up, Tate reported. He knows we're coming. But he's only got one left. Unless his reload crews are really hot today. Well, you can't allow for everything. Some light flak at 10 o'clock. It was too far to be a matter of concern, though it did tell him which way out not to take. There's the plateau. Maybe they could see him, maybe not. Possibly he was just one moving blip amid a screen full of clutter that some radar operator was striving to understand. The thud moved faster at low level than anything ever made, and the camouflage motif on the upper surfaces was effective. They were probably looking up. There was a wall of jamming there now, part of the plan he'd laid out for the other weasel bird, and normal American tactics were for a medium-altitude approach and steep dive. But they'd done that twice and failed, and so Zacharias decided to change the technique. Low level, he'd rock-eye the place, then the other weasel would finish things off. His job was killing the command van and the commander within. He jinked the thud left and right, up and down, to deny a good shooting track to anybody on the ground. You still had to worry about guns, too. Got the star, Robin said. The SA-6 manual, written in Russian, called for 6 launchers around a central control point. With all the connective paths, the typical guideline site looked just like a Star of David, which seemed rather blasphemous to the colonel, but the thought only hovered at the edge of his mind as he centered the command van on his bombsight pipper. Selecting Rockeye, he said aloud, confirming the action to himself. For the last 10 seconds he held the aircraft rock steady. Looking good. Release. Now. 4 of the decidedly un-aerodynamic canisters fell free of the fighter's ejector racks, splitting open in midair, scattering thousands of submunitions over the area. He was well beyond the site before the bomblets landed. He didn't see people running for slit trenches, but he stayed low, reefing the thud into a tight left turn, looking up to make sure he'd gotten the place once and for all. From 3 miles out, his eyes caught an immense cloud of smoke in the center of the star. That's for Al, he allowed himself to think. No victory roll, just a thought, as he leveled out and picked a likely spot to egress the area. The strike force could come in now, and that SAM battery was out of business. Okay. He selected a notch in the ridge, racing for it just under Mach 1, straight and level now that the threat was behind him. Home for Christmas. The red tracers that erupted from the small pass startled him. That wasn't supposed to be there. No deflection on them, just coming right in. He jinked up, as the gunner had thought he would, and the body of the aircraft passed right through the stream of fire. It shook violently, and in the passage of a second, good changed to evil. "Robin," a voice gasped over the intercom. But the main noise was from wailing alarms, and Zacharias knew in a fatal instant that his aircraft was doomed. It got worse almost before he could react. The engine died in flames, and then the thud started a roll yaw that told him the controls were gone. His reaction was automatic, a shout for ejection. But another gasp from the back made him turn just as he yanked the handles, even though he knew the gesture was useless. His last sight of Jack Tate was blood that hung below the seat like a vapor trail. But by then his own back was wrenched with more pain than he'd ever known. "Okay," Kelly said, and fired off a flare. Another boat started tossing small explosive charges into the water to drive the fish away from the area. He watched and waited for 5 minutes, then looked at the safety man. "Area's clear." "Fire in the hole," Kelly said, repeating the mantra 3 times more. Then he twisted the handle on the detonator. The results were gratifying. The water around the legs turned to foam as the rig's legs were chopped off bottom and top. The fall was surprisingly slow. The entire structure slid off in one direction. There was an immense splash as the platform hit, and for one incongruous moment it appeared as though steel might float. But it couldn't. The see-through collection of light I-beams sank below sight, to rest right on the bottom, and another job was done. Kelly disconnected the wires from the generator and tossed them over the side. 2 weeks early. I guess you really wanted that bonus, the executive said. A former Navy fighter pilot, he admired a job well and quickly done. The oil wasn't going anywhere after all. Dutch was right about you. The Admiral is a good guy. He's done a lot for Tish and me. Well, we flew together for 2 years. Badass fighter jock. Good to know those nice things he said were true. The executive liked working with people who'd had experiences like his own. He'd forgotten the terror of combat somehow. What's with that? I've been meaning to ask. He pointed to the tattoo on Kelly's arm, a red seal, sitting up on his hind flippers and grinning impudently. Something we all did in my unit, Kelly explained as offhandedly as he could. What unit was that? Can't say. Kelly added a grin to mute the refusal. I'll bet it's something to do with how Sonny got out, but okay. A former naval officer had to respect the rules. Well, the check'll be in your account by the end of the business day, Mr. Kelly. I'll radio in so your wife can pick you up. Tish Kelly was glowing her Me Too look at the women in the Stork shop. Not even 3 months yet, she could wear anything she wanted. Well, almost. Too soon to shop for anything special, but she had the free time and wanted to see what the options were. She thanked the clerk, deciding that she'd bring John here in the evening and help him pick something out for her because he liked doing that. Now it was time to pick him up. The Plymouth wagon they'd driven down from Maryland was parked right outside, and she'd learned to navigate the streets of the coastal town. It was a nice break from the cold autumn rain of their home, to be here on the Gulf Coast where the summer was never really gone for more than a few days. She brought the wagon onto the street, heading south for the oil company's huge support yard. Even the traffic lights were in her favor. One changed to green in such a timely fashion that her foot didn't even have to touch the brakes. The truck driver frowned as the light changed to amber. He was late, and running a little too fast, but the end of his 600-mile run from Oklahoma was in sight. He stepped on the clutch and brake pedals with a sigh that abruptly changed to a gasp of surprise as both pedals went all the way to the floor at the same speed. The road ahead was clear, and he kept going straight, downshifting to cut speed and frantically blowing his diesel horn. Oh, God, please don't. She never saw it coming. Her head never turned. The station wagon just jumped right through the intersection, and the driver's lingering memory would be of the young woman's profile disappearing under the hood of his diesel tractor. and then the awful lurch and shuddering surge upwards as the truck crushed the wagon under his front wheels. The worst part of all was not feeling. Helen was her friend. Helen was dying, and Pam knew she should feel something, but she couldn't. The body was gagged, but that didn't stop all the sounds as Billy and Rick did what they were doing. Breath found its way out, and though her mouth couldn't move, the sounds were those of a woman soon to leave her life behind. But the trip had a price which had to be paid first. And Rick and Billy and Bert and Henry were doing the collecting. She tried to tell herself that she was really in another place, but the awful choking sounds kept bringing her eyes and her consciousness back to what reality had become. Helen was bad. Helen had tried to run away, and they couldn't have that. It had been explained to them all more than once, and was now being explained again in a way, Henry said, that they would be sure to remember. Pam felt where her ribs had once been broken, remembering her lesson. She knew there was nothing she could do as Helen's eyes fixed on her face. She tried to convey sympathy with her eyes. She didn't dare do more than that, and presently Helen stopped making noise. And it was over, for now. Now she could close her eyes and wonder when it would be her turn. The crew thought it was pretty funny. They had the American pilot tied up right outside their sandbagged emplacement so he could see the guns that had shot him down. Less funny was what their prisoner had done, and they'd expressed their displeasure for it with fists and boots. They had the other body, too, and they set it right next to him, enjoying the look of sorrow and despair on his face as he looked at his fellow bandit. The intelligence officer from Hanoi was here now, checking the man's name against a list he'd brought along, bending down again to read off the name. It must have been something special, the gunners all thought, from the way he reacted to it, and the urgent phone call he'd made. After the prisoner passed out from his pain, the intelligence officer had swabbed some blood from the dead body and covered the live one's face with it. Then he'd snapped a few photos. That puzzled the gun crew. It was almost as though he wanted the live one to look as dead as the body next to him. How very odd. It wasn't the first body he'd had to identify, but Kelly had thought that aspect of his life was a thing left far behind. Other people were there to support him, but not falling down wasn't the same thing as surviving, and there was no consolation at a moment such as this. He walked out of the emergency room, people's eyes on him, doctors and nurses. A priest had been called to perform his last duty, and had said a few things that he knew were unheard. A police officer explained that it hadn't been the driver's fault. The brakes had failed. Mechanical defect. Nobody's fault, really. Just one of those things. All the things he'd said before, on other such occasions, trying to explain to some innocent person why the main part of his world had just ended, as though it mattered. This Mr. Kelly was a tough one, the officer saw, and all the more vulnerable because of it. His wife and unborn child, whom he might have protected against any hazard, were dead by an accident. Nobody to blame. The trucker, a family man himself, was in the hospital, under sedation after having gone under his rig in the hope of finding her alive. People Kelly had been working with sat with him, and would help him make arrangements. There was nothing else to be done for a man who would have accepted hell rather than this, because he'd seen hell. But there was more than one hell, and he hadn't seen them all quite yet. Chapter 1 Enfant Perdu May. He'd never know why he stopped. Kelly pulled his scout over to the shoulder without a conscious thought. She hadn't had her hand out, soliciting a ride. She'd just been standing at the side of the road, watching the cars speed past in a spray of highway grit and a wake of fumes. Her posture was that of a hitchhiker, one knee locked, the other bent. Her clothes were clearly well used, and a backpack was loosely slung over one shoulder. Her tawny, shoulder-length hair moved about in the rush of air from the traffic. Her face showed nothing, but Kelly didn't see that until he was already pressing his right foot on the brake pedal and angling onto the loose rock of the shoulder. He wondered if he should go back into the traffic, then decided that he was already committed, though to what he didn't know exactly. The girl's eyes followed the car, and as he looked in his rearview mirror, she shrugged without any particular enthusiasm and walked towards him. The passenger window was down already, and in a few seconds she was there. "Where you going?" she asked. That surprised Kelly. He thought the first question, "Need a ride?" was supposed to be his. He hesitated for a second or two, looking at her. 21, perhaps, but old for her years. Her face wasn't dirty, but neither was it clean, perhaps from the wind and dust on the interstate. She wore a man's cotton shirt that hadn't been ironed in months, and her hair was knotted. But what surprised him most of all were her eyes. Fetchingly gray-green, they stared past Kelly into... what? He'd seen the look before often enough, but only on weary men. He'd had the look himself, Kelly remembered. But even then he'd never known what his eyes saw. It didn't occur to him that he wore a look not so different now. "Back to my boat," he answered finally, not knowing what else to say. And that quickly her eyes changed. "You have a boat?" she asked. Her eyes lit up like a child's. A smile started there and radiated down the remainder of her face, as though he'd just answered an important question. She had a cute gap between her front teeth, Kelly noticed. 40-footer. She's a diesel cruiser. He waved to the back of the Scout, whose cargo area was completely filled with cartons of groceries. "You want to come along?" he asked, also without thinking. "Sure." Without hesitation, she yanked open the door and tossed her backpack on the floor in front of the passenger seat. Pulling back into traffic was dangerous. Short of wheelbase and short of power, the Scout wasn't built for interstate highway driving, and Kelly had to concentrate. The car wasn't fast enough to go in any other lane than the right, and with people coming on and off at every interchange, he had to pay attention because the Scout wasn't nimble enough to avoid all the idiots who were heading out to the ocean or wherever the hell people went on a 3-day weekend. "You want to come along?" he'd asked, and she'd said sure, his mind reported to him. What the hell? Kelly frowned in frustration at the traffic because he didn't know the answer. But then there were a lot of questions to which he hadn't known the answers in the last 6 months. He told his mind to be quiet and watch the traffic, even though it kept up its inquiries in a nagging sort of background noise. One's mind, after all, rarely obeys its own commands. Memorial Day weekend, he thought. The cars around him were filled with people rushing home from work, or those who'd already made that trip and picked up their families. The faces of children stared out of the rear seat windows. One or two waved at him, but Kelly pretended not to notice. It was hard not having a soul, most especially when you could remember having had one. Kelly ran a hand across his jaw, feeling the sandpaper texture. The hand itself was dirty. No wonder they'd acted that way at the grocery warehouse. Letting yourself go, Kelly. Well, who the hell cares? He turned to look at his guest and realized that he didn't know her name. He was taking her to his boat, and he didn't know her name. Amazing. She was staring forward, her face serene. It was a pretty face in profile. She was thin. Perhaps willowy was the right word, her hair halfway between blonde and brown. Her jeans were worn and torn in a few places, and had begun life at one of those stores where they charged you extra to sell jeans that were pre-faded, or whatever they did with them. Kelly didn't know and cared less. One more thing not to care about. "Christ, how did you ever get this screwed up?" his mind demanded of him. He knew the answer, but even that was not a full explanation. Different segments of the organism called John Terence Kelly knew different parts of the whole story. But somehow they'd never all come together, leaving the separate fragments of what had once been a tough, smart, decisive man to blunder about in confusion. And despair? There was a happy thought. He remembered what he'd once been. He remembered all the things that he had survived, amazed that he had done so. And perhaps the worst torment of all was that he didn't understand what had gone wrong. Sure, he knew what had happened, but those things had all been on the outside, and somehow his understanding had gotten lost, leaving him alive and confused and without purpose. He was on autopilot. He knew that, but not where fate was taking him. She didn't try to talk, whoever she was, and that was just as well, Kelly told himself, though he sensed that there was something he ought to know. The realization came as a surprise. It was instinctual, and he'd always trusted his instincts, the warning chill on his neck and forearms. He looked around at the traffic, and Kelly saw no particular danger other than cars with too much engine under the hood and not enough brains behind the wheel. His eyes scanned carefully and found nothing. But the warning didn't go away. And Kelly found himself checking the mirror for no good reason, while his left hand wandered down between his legs and found the checkered grips of the Colt automatic that hung hidden under the seat. His hand was stroking the weapon before he realized it. "Now what the hell did you do that for?" Kelly pulled his hand back and shook his head with a grimace of frustration. But he did keep checking the mirror. Just the normal watch on traffic, he lied to himself for the next 20 minutes. The boatyard was a swarm of activity. The 3-day weekend, of course. Cars were zipping about too fast for the small and badly paved parking lot, each driver trying to evade the Friday rush that each was, of course, helping to create. At least here the scout came into its own. The high ground clearance and visibility gave Kelly an advantage as he maneuvered to Springer's transom, and he looped around to back up to the slip he'd left 6 hours before. It was a relief to crank up the windows and lock the car. His adventure on the highways was over, and the safety of the trackless water beckoned. Springer was a diesel-powered motor yacht, 41 feet long, custom-built, but similar in her lines and internal arrangements to a pacemaker Coho. She was not especially pretty, but she had 2 sizable cabins, and the midships salon could be converted easily into a third. Her diesels were large but not supercharged, because Kelly preferred a large, comfortable engine to a small, straining one. He had a high-quality marine radar, every sort of communications gear that he could legally use, and navigation aids normally reserved for offshore fishermen. The fiberglass hull was immaculate, and there was not a speck of rust on the chromed rails, though he had deliberately done without the topside varnish that most yacht owners cherished because it wasn't worth the maintenance time. Springer was a work boat, or was supposed to be. Kelly and his guest alighted from the car. He opened the cargo door and started carrying the cartons aboard. The young lady he saw had the good sense to stay out of the way.
"Yo, Kelly!" a voice called from the flying bridge.
"Yeah, Ed, what is it?"
"Bad gauge. The generator brushes were a little worn, and I replaced them, but I think it was the gauge. Replace that, too."
Ed Murdoch, the yard's chief mechanic, started down, and spotted the girl as he began to step off the ladder. Murdoch tripped on the last step and nearly landed flat on his face in surprise. The mechanic's face evaluated the girl quickly and approvingly.
"Anything else?" Kelly asked pointedly.
"Topped off the tanks. The engines are warm," Murdoch said, turning back to his customer. "It's all on your bill."
"Okay, thanks, Ed."
"Oh, Chip told me to tell you. Somebody else made an offer in case you ever want to sell."
Kelly cut him off. "No chance, Ed."
"She's a jewel, Kelly," Murdoch said as he gathered his tools and walked away smiling, pleased with himself for the double entendre.
It took several seconds for Kelly to catch that one. It evoked a belated grunt of semi-amusement as he loaded the last of the groceries into the salon.
"What do I do?" the girl asked. She'd just been standing there, and Kelly had the impression that she was trembling a little and trying to hide it.
"Just take a seat topside," Kelly said, pointing to the flying bridge. "It'll take me a few minutes to get things started."
"Okay."
She beamed a smile at him, guaranteed to melt ice, as though she knew exactly what one of his needs was. Kelly walked aft to his cabin, pleased at last that he kept his boat tidy. The master cabin head was also neat, and he found himself staring into the mirror and asking, "Okay, now what the fuck are you going to do?" There was no immediate answer, but common decency told him to wash up. 2 minutes later, he entered the salon. He checked to see that the grocery cartons were secure, then went topside.
"I forgot to ask you something," he began.
"Pam," she said, extending her hand.
"What's yours?"
"Kelly," he replied, nonplussed yet again.
"Where are we going, Mr. Kelly?"
"Just Kelly," he corrected her, keeping his distance for the moment. Pam just nodded and smiled again.
"Okay, Kelly, where to?"
"I own a little island about 30...
"You own an island?"
Her eyes went wide.
"That's right."
Actually, he just leased it, and that had been a fact long enough that Kelly didn't find it the least bit remarkable.
"Let's go," she said with enthusiasm, looking back at the shore.
Kelly laughed out loud.
"Okay, let's do that."
He flipped on the bilge blowers. Springer had diesel engines, and he didn't really have to worry about fumes building up. But for all his recently acquired slovenliness, Kelly was a seaman, and his life on the water followed a strict routine, which meant observing all the safety rules that had been written in the blood of less careful men. After the prescribed 2 minutes, he punched the button to start the port side, then the starboard side diesel. Both of the big Detroit diesel engines caught at once, rumbling to impressive life as Kelly checked the gauges. Everything looked fine. He left the flying bridge to slip his mooring lines, then came back and eased the throttles forward to take his boat out of the slip, checking tide and wind. There was not much of either at the moment, and looking for other boats. Kelly advanced the port throttle a notch farther as he turned the wheel, allowing Springer to pivot all the more quickly in the narrow channel, and then he was pointed straight out. He advanced the starboard throttle next, bringing his cruiser to a mannerly 5 knots as he headed past the ranks of motor and sail yachts. Pam was looking around at the boats too, mainly aft, and her eyes fixed on the parking lot for a long couple of seconds before she looked forward again, her body relaxing more as she did so.
"You know anything about boats?" Kelly asked.
"Not much," she admitted, and for the first time he noticed her accent.
"Where are you from?"
"Texas. How about you?"
"Indianapolis, originally, but it's been a while."
"What's this?" she asked. Her hands reached out to touch the tattoo on his forearm.
"It's from one of the places I've been," he said. "Not a very nice place."
"Oh, over there."
She understood.
"That's the place."
Kelly nodded matter-of-factly.
They were out of the yacht basin now, and he advanced the throttles yet again.
"What did you do there?"
"Nothing to talk to a lady about," Kelly replied, looking around from a half-standing position.
"What makes you think I'm a lady?" she asked.
It caught him short, but he was getting used to it by now. He'd also found that talking to a girl, no matter what the subject, was something that he needed to do. For the first time, he answered her smile with one of his own.
"Well, it wouldn't be very nice of me if I assumed that you weren't."
"I wondered how long it would be before you smiled."
"You have a very nice smile," her tone told him.
"How's 6 months grab you?" he almost said. Instead, he laughed, mainly at himself. That was something else he needed to do.
"I'm sorry. Guess I haven't been very good company."
He turned to look at her again and saw understanding in her eyes. Just a quiet look, very human and feminine, but it shook Kelly. He could feel it happen, and ignored the part of his consciousness that told him it was something he'd needed badly for months. That was something he didn't need to hear, especially from himself.
Loneliness was bad enough without reflection on its misery. Her hand reached out yet again, ostensibly to stroke the tattoo. But that wasn't what it was all about. It was amazing how warm her touch was, even under a hot afternoon sun. Perhaps it was a measure of just how cold his life had become. But he had a boat to navigate. There was a freighter about 1,000 yards ahead. Kelly was now at full cruising power, and the trim tabs at the stern had automatically engaged, bringing the boat to an efficient planing angle as her speed came to 18 knots. The ride was smooth until they got into the merchant ship's wake. Then Springer started pitching, up and down 3 or 4 feet at the bow as Kelly maneuvered left to get around the worst of it. The freighter grew before them like a cliff as they overtook her. "Is there some place I can change?" "My cabin is aft. You can move in forward if you want." "Oh, really?" She giggled. "Why would I do that?" "Huh?" She'd done it to him again. Pam went below, careful to hold on to the rails as she carried her backpack. She hadn't been wearing much. She reappeared in a few minutes wearing even less, short shorts and a halter, no shoes, and perceptibly more relaxed. She had dancer's legs, Kelly noticed, slim and very feminine. Also very pale, which surprised him. The halter was loose on her and frayed at the edges. Perhaps she'd recently lost weight, or maybe she'd deliberately bought it over large. Whatever the reason, it showed quite a bit of her chest. Kelly caught himself shifting his eyes, and chastised himself for ogling the girl. But Pam made it hard not to. Now she grasped his upper arm and sat up against him. Looking over, he could see right down the halter just as far as he wanted. "You like them?" she asked. Kelly's brain and mouth went into lock. He made a few embarrassed sounds, and before he could decide to say anything, she was laughing. But not at him. She was waving at the crew of the freighter, who waved back. It was an Italian ship, and one of the half-dozen or so men hanging over the rail at the stern blew Pam a kiss. She did the same in return. It made Kelly jealous. He turned the wheel to port again, taking his boat across the bow wave of the freighter, and as he passed the vessel's bridge, he tooted his horn. It was the correct thing to do, though few small boaters ever bothered. By this time, a watch officer had his glasses on Kelly. Actually, Pam, of course. He turned and shouted something to the wheelhouse. A moment later, the freighter's enormous whistle sounded its own bass note, nearly causing the girl to leap from her seat. Kelly laughed, and so did she, and then she wrapped her arms tightly around his bicep. He could feel a finger tracing its way around the tattoo. "It doesn't feel like..." Kelly nodded. "I know. Most people expect it to feel like paint or something." "Why did..." "I get it." "Everybody in the outfit did. Even the officers. It was something to do, I guess. Pretty dumb, really."
"I think it's cute."
"Well, I think you're pretty cute."
"You say the nicest things."
She moved slightly, rubbing her breast against his upper arm. Kelly settled down to a steady cruising speed of 18 knots as he worked his way out of Baltimore Harbor. The Italian freighter was the only merchant ship in view, and the seas were flat, with 1-foot ripples. He kept to the main shipping channel all the way out into the Chesapeake Bay. "You thirsty?" she asked as they turned south. "Yeah, there's a fridge in the kitchenette. It's in the..."
"I saw it. What do you want?"
"Get 2 of anything."
"Okay,"
she replied brightly. When she stood, the soft feeling worked its way straight up his arm, finally departing at the shoulder.
"What's that?"
she asked on returning. Kelly turned and winced. He'd been so content with the girl on his arm that he'd neglected to pay attention to the weather. That was a thunderstorm, a towering mass of cumulonimbus clouds that reached 8 or 10 miles skyward. "Looks like we're going to get some rain," he told her as he took the beer from her hand.
"When I was a little girl, that meant a tornado."
"Well, not here it doesn't," Kelly replied, looking around the boat to make sure that there was no loose gear. Below, he knew, everything was in its proper place, because it always was, ennui or not. Then he switched on his marine radio. He caught a weather forecast at once, one that ended with the usual warning.
"Is this a small craft?" Pam asked.
"Technically it is, but you can relax. I know what I'm doing. I used to be a chief bosun's mate."
"What's that?"
"A sailor. In the Navy, that is. Besides, this is a pretty big boat. The ride might get a little bumpy, is all. If you're worried, there are life jackets under the seat you're on."
"Are you worried?" Pam asked.
Kelly smiled and shook his head.
"Okay."
She resumed her previous position, her chest against his arm, her head on his shoulder, a dreamy expression in her eyes, as though anticipating something that was to be, storm or no storm. Kelly wasn't worried, at least not about the storm, but he wasn't casual about things either. Passing Bodkin Point, he continued east across the shipping channel. He didn't turn south until he was in water he knew to be too shallow for anything large enough to run him down. Every few minutes he turned to keep an eye on the storm, which was charging right in at 20 knots or so. It had already blotted out the sun. A fast-moving storm most often meant a violent one, and his new southerly course meant that he wasn't outrunning it any longer. Kelly finished off his beer and decided against another. Visibility would drop fast. He pulled out a plastic-coated chart and fixed it in place on the table to the right of the instrument panel, marked his position with a grease pencil, and then checked to make sure that his course didn't take him into shallows. Springer drew 4.5 feet of water, and for Kelly, anything less than 8 feet constituted shallow water. Satisfied, he set his compass course and relaxed again. His training was his buffer against both danger and complacency.
"Won't be long now," Pam observed, just a trace of unease in her voice as she held on to him.
"You can head below if you want," Kelly said. "It's going to get rainy and windy, and bumpy."
"But not dangerous."
"No, unless I do something really dumb." "I'll try not to," he promised.
"Can I stay here and see what it's like?" she asked, clearly unwilling to leave his side, though Kelly did not know why.
"It's going to get wet," he warned her again.
"That's okay."
She smiled brightly, fixing even more tightly to his arm. Kelly throttled back some, taking the boat down off plane. There was no reason to hurry. With the throttles eased back, there was no longer a need for two hands on the controls, either. He wrapped his arms around the girl. Her head came automatically down on his shoulder again, and despite the approaching storm, everything was suddenly right with the world. Or that's what Kelly's emotions told him. His reason said something else, and the two views would not reconcile themselves. His reason reminded him that the girl at his side was... what? He didn't know. His emotions told him that it didn't matter a damn. She was what he needed. But Kelly was not a man ruled by emotions, and the conflict made him glower at the horizon.
"Something wrong?" Pam asked.
Kelly started to say something, then stopped, and reminded himself that he was alone on his yacht with a pretty girl. He let emotion win this round for a change. "I'm a little confused, but no, nothing is wrong that I know about."
"I can tell that you..."
Kelly shook his head. "Don't bother. Whatever it is, it can wait. Just relax and enjoy the ride." The first gust of wind arrived a moment later, heeling the boat a few degrees to port. Kelly adjusted his rudder to compensate. The rain arrived quickly. The first few warning sprinkles were rapidly followed by solid sheets that marched like curtains across the surface of the Chesapeake Bay. Within a minute, visibility was down to only a few hundred yards, and the sky was as dark as late twilight. Kelly made sure his running lights were on. The waves started kicking up in earnest, driven by what felt like 30 knots of wind. Weather and seas were directly on the beam. He decided that he could keep going, but he was in a good anchoring place now, and wouldn't be in another for 5 hours. Kelly took another look at the chart, then switched on his radar to verify his position. 10 feet of water, a sand bottom that the chart called HRD and was therefore good holding ground. He brought Springer into the wind and eased the throttles until the propellers were providing just enough thrust to overcome the driving force of the wind. "Take the wheel," he told Pam. "But I don't know what to do." "It's all right. Just hold her steady and steer the way I tell you to. I have to go forward to set the anchors, okay?"
"You be careful," she shouted over the gusting wind.
The waves were about 5 feet now, and the bow of the boat was leaping up and down. Kelly gave her shoulder a squeeze and went forward. He had to watch himself, of course, but his shoes had no skid soles, and Kelly knew his business. He kept his hands on the grab rail all the way around the superstructure, and in a minute he was on the foredeck. Two anchors were clipped to the deck, a Danforth and a CQR plow type, both slightly oversized. He tossed the Danforth over first, then signaled for Pam to ease the wheel to port. When the boat had moved perhaps 50 feet south, he dropped the CQR over the side as well. Both ropes were already set to the proper lengths, and after checking that all was secure, Kelly made his way back to the flying bridge. Pam looked nervous until the moment that he sat back down on the vinyl bench. Everything was covered with water now, and their clothes were soaked through. Kelly eased the throttles to idle, allowing the wind to push Springer back nearly 100 feet. By that time, both anchors had dug into the bottom. Kelly frowned at their placement. He ought to have set them farther apart. But only one anchor was really necessary. The second was just insurance. Satisfied, he switched off the diesels. "I could fight the storm all the way down, but I'd prefer not to," he explained.
"So we park here for the night?"
"That's right. You can go down to your cabin and..."
"You want me to go away?"
"No. I mean, if you don't like it here." Her hand came up to his face. He barely caught her words through the wind and rain.
"I like it here."
Somehow it didn't seem like a contradiction at all. A moment later, Kelly asked himself why it had taken so long. All the signals had been there. There was another brief discussion between emotion and reason lost again. There was nothing to be afraid of here, just a person as lonely as he. It was so easy to forget. Loneliness didn't tell you what you had lost, only that something was missing. It took something like this to define that emptiness. Her skin was soft, dripping with rain, but warm. It was so different from the rented passion that he'd tried twice in the past month, each time coming away disgusted with himself. But this was something else. This was real. Reason cried out one last time that it couldn't be, that he'd picked her up at the side of the road and had known her for only a brief span of hours. Emotion said that it didn't matter. As though observing the conflict in his mind, Pam pulled the halter over her head. Emotion won.
"They look just fine to me," Kelly said.
His hand moved to them, touching delicately. They felt just fine, too. Pam hung the halter on the steering wheel and pressed her face against his, her hands pulling him forward, taking charge in a very feminine way. Somehow her passion wasn't animalistic. Something made it different. Kelly didn't know what it was, but didn't search for the reason, not now. Both rose to their feet. Pam nearly slipped, but Kelly caught her, dropping to his knees to help remove her shorts. Then it was her turn to unbutton his shirt, after placing his hands on her breasts. His shirt remained in place for a long moment because neither wanted his hands to move, but then it was done, one arm at a time, and his jeans went next. Kelly slipped out of his shoes as the rest came off. Both stood for the next embrace, weaving as the boat pitched and rocked beneath them, the rain and wind pelting them. Pam took his hand and led him just aft of the driver's console, guiding him down to a supine position on the deck. She mounted him at once. Kelly tried to sit up, but she didn't let him, instead leaning forward while her hips moved with gentle violence. Kelly was as unready for that as he'd been for everything else this afternoon, and his shout seemed to outscream the thunder. When his eyes opened, her face was inches from him, and the smile was like that on a stone angel in a church. "I'm sorry, Pam, I..." She stopped his apology with a giggle. "Are you always this good?" Long minutes later, Kelly's arms were wrapped around her thin form, and so they stayed until the storm passed. Kelly was afraid to let go, afraid of the possibility that this was as unreal as it had to be. Then the wind acquired a chill, and they went below. Kelly got some towels, and they dried each other off. He tried to smile at her, but the hurt was back, all the more powerful from the joy of the previous hour, and it was Pam's turn to be surprised. She sat beside him on the deck of the salon, and when she pulled his face down to her chest, he was the one who wept, until her chest was wet again. She didn't ask. She was smart enough for that. Instead, she held him tightly until he was done and his breathing came back to normal. "I'm sorry," he said after a while. Kelly tried to move, but she wouldn't let him. "You don't have to explain. But I'd like to help," she said, knowing that she already had. She'd seen it from almost the first moment in the car, a strong man badly hurt, so different from the others she had known. When he finally spoke, she could feel his words on her breast. "It's been nearly 7 months. Down in Mississippi on a job. She was pregnant. We just found out. She went to the store and... it was a truck. A big tractor-trailer rig. The linkage broke." He couldn't make himself say more, and he didn't have to. "What was her name?" "Tish. Patricia." "How long were you?" "Year and a half." "Then she was just... gone. I never expected it. I mean, I put my time in, did some dangerous stuff, but that's all over. And that was me, not her. I never thought..." His voice cracked again. Pam looked down at him in the muted light of the salon, seeing the scars she'd missed before, and wondering what their story was. It didn't matter. She brought her cheek down to the top of his head. He should have been a father right about now. Should have been a lot of things. "You never let it out, did you?"
"No."
"And why now?"
"I don't know," he whispered.
"Thank you." Kelly looked up in surprise. "That's the nicest thing a man has ever done to me."
"I don't understand."
"Yes, you do," Pam replied.
"And Tish understands, too. You let me take her place. Or maybe she did. She loved you, John. She must have loved you a lot. And she still does. Thank you for letting me help."
He started crying again, and Pam brought his head back down, cradling him like a small child. It lasted 10 minutes, though neither looked at a clock. When he was done, he kissed her in gratitude that rapidly turned to renewed passion. Pam lay back, letting him take charge as he needed to do, now that he was again a man in spirit. Her reward was in keeping with the magnitude of what she had done for him. And this time it was her cries that canceled out the thunder. Later, he fell asleep at her side, and she kissed his unshaven cheek. That was when her own tears began at the wonder of what the day had brought, after the terror with which it had begun. Chapter 2. Encounters. Kelly awoke at his accustomed time, 30 minutes before sunrise, to the mewing of gulls, and saw the first dull glow on the eastern horizon. At first he was confused to find a slender arm across his chest, but other feelings and memories explained things in a few seconds. He extricated himself from her side and moved the blanket to cover her from the morning chill. It was time for ship's business. Kelly got the drip coffee machine going, then he pulled on a pair of swim trunks and headed topside. He hadn't forgotten to set the anchor light, he was gratified to see. The sky had cleared off, and the air was cool after the thunderstorms of the previous night. He went forward and was surprised to see that one of his anchors had dragged somewhat. Kelly reproached himself for that, even though nothing had actually gone wrong. The water was a flat, oily calm, and the breeze gentle. The pink-orange glow of first light decorated the tree-spotted coastline to the east. All in all, it seemed as fine a morning as he could remember. Then he remembered that what had changed had nothing at all to do with the weather. "Damn," he whispered to the dawn not yet broken. Kelly was stiff, and did some stretching exercises to get the kinks out, slow to realize how fine he felt without the usual hangover, slower still to recall how long it had been. 9 hours of sleep, he wondered, that much? No wonder he felt so good. The next part of the morning routine was to get a squeegee to dispose of the water that had pooled on the fiberglass deck. His head turned at the low, muted rumble of marine diesels. Kelly looked west to spot it, but there was a little mist that way, being pushed his way by the breeze, and he couldn't make anything out. He went to the control station on the flying bridge and got out his glasses, just in time to have a 12-inch spotlight blaze through the marine 7x50s. Kelly was dazzled by the lights, which just as suddenly switched off, and a loud hailer called across the water. "Sorry, Kelly, didn't know it was you." 2 minutes later, the familiar shape of a Coast Guard 41-foot patrol boat eased alongside Springer. Kelly scrambled along the port side to deploy his rubber fenders. "You trying to kill me or something?" Kelly said in a conversational voice. "Sorry." Quartermaster First Class Manuel Portagee Areza stepped from one gunwale to the other with practiced ease. He gestured to the fenders. "Want to hurt my feelings?" "Bad sea manners, too," Kelly went on as he walked toward his visitor. "I spoke to the young lad about that already," Areza assured him. He held out his hand. "Morning, Kelly." The outstretched hand had a styrofoam cup filled with coffee. Kelly took it and laughed. "Apology accepted, sir." Areza was famous for his coffee. "Long night. We're all tired, and it's a young crew," the Coast Guardsman explained wearily. Areza was nearly 28 himself, and by far the oldest man of his boat crew. "Trouble?" Kelly asked. Areza nodded, looking around at the water. "Kinda. Some damn fool and a little day sailor turned up missing after that little rainstorm we had last night, and we've been looking all over Bejazzes for him." 40 knots of wind. Fair blow, Portagee," Kelly pointed out. "Came in right fast, too." "Yeah, well, we rescued 6 boats already, just this one still missing. You see anything unusual last night?" "No. Came out of Baltimore around, 1600, I suppose. 2.5 hours to get here. Anchored right after the storm hit. Visibility was pretty bad. Didn't see much of anything before we went below." "We," Areza observed, stretching. He walked over to the wheel, picked up the rain-soaked halter, and tossed it to Kelly. The look on his face was neutral, but there was interest behind the eyes. He hoped his friend had found someone. Life hadn't been especially fair to the man. Kelly handed the cup back with a similarly neutral expression. "There was one freighter coming out behind us," he went on. "Italian flag, container boat about half full, must have been knocking down 15 knots. Anybody else clear the harbor?" "Yeah." Areza nodded and spoke with professional irritation. "I'm worried about that. Fucking Merchie's plowing out at full speed, not paying attention." "Well, hell, you stand outside the wheelhouse, you might get wet. Besides, sea and anchor detail might violate some union rule, right?" "Maybe your guy got run down," Kelly noted darkly. It wouldn't have been the first time, even on a body of water as civilized as the Chesapeake. "Maybe," Areza said, surveying the horizon. He frowned, not believing the suggestion and too tired to hide it. "Anyway, you see a little day sailor with an orange and white candy stripe sail, you want to give me a call?" "No problem." Areza looked forward and turned back. 2 anchors for that little puff of wind we had? They're not far enough apart. Thought you knew better." "Chief Bosun's mate," Kelly reminded him. "Since when does a bookkeeper get that snotty with a real seaman?" It was only a joke. Kelly knew Portagee was the better man in a small boat, though not by much of a margin, and both knew that, too. Areza grinned on his way back to the cutter. After jumping back aboard, he pointed to the halter in Kelly's hand. "Don't forget to put your shirt on, Boats. Looks like it ought to fit just fine." A laughing Oreza disappeared.